watch them grow up.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, that question is asked mainly by New Yorkers. And New Yorkers believe that they live in the center of the sun, and they say, why Dallas? Well, Dallas is a charming city.
Well, you know,
grandchildren is more charming.
That's true. I think you're probably right, but I have a fondness for Dallas, being that I come from Houston, so
oh,
I know what you're talking about.
Yes, yes.
Well, you lived in Ireland for many years. What was it like for a writer living in Ireland?
Well, it was, for a writer, it was absolutely perfect conditions. And finally, when we left because there was too much serenity. We had a house on a hill that was designed, that had been designed by James Hoban, who designed the White House in Washington. And you would look out 60 square miles, and nothing moved except a cow or a sheep or the occasional Guinness salesman. And it was a completely idyllic, quiet, charming, relaxed place. But toward the end, we began to get that uneasy feeling that we were missing something, that old human condition. And by that time, these grandchildren were growing up, and we weren't seeing them except about twice a year.
How many years did you live in Ireland?
We lived overseas all together for 27, and 9 in Ireland and almost 10 in Switzerland, and then in France and Spain and Mexico.
Why? Why did you globetrot so much?
Well, we started out with the idea that it would be good for the girls. My older girl speaks now 5 languages very well. My younger one speaks 3. And in the course of this whole thing, I discovered that as a writer, I was slowly reaching the absolute conclusion that people are the same no matter where you live. So that my books have been, my first book was a book about Spain and France, and I had the feeling that I didn't have to hold back, that I understood the people even though I had lived among them for such a short time.
Well, you mentioned the idyllic life in Ireland, but wouldn't this be a perfect atmosphere for writing, away from the sirens and the noise and the jet airplanes and all that?
Yes, but I think every now and then you have to come back into conflict with the society, just to produce the same conflict that produces drama. And we just had too much quiet and too much serenity.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a culture shock in reentering the United States?
Yeah, I sure did. My word, we live now in a little enclave in the Dallas. It's surrounded by the city, and it's called Park City, and it looks like the old backlot at Metro when they made the Judge Hardy pictures. Mm-hmm. All these little houses with trees and all that stuff, and Dallas is made up entirely of villages, and call them shopping centers, call whatever you want to, but there's about 210 of them, and you put them all together to make this one city. So it was our village in Ireland was 325, and before that we had been in Locarno, which was 11,000 when we moved there, and about 26 when we left.
So what were the major problems you had after 27 years of living overseas and readjusting to the United States?
No, the past had taken care of everything. We had settled into a habituation of life whereby my wife always spoke the languages, so that I had very little contact, and I've always worked for the past all these years for 7 hours a day, 7 days a week, and I'm doing the same thing in Dallas. It's just a matter that the restaurants are different, actually.
How did Dallas, how long have you been back in Dallas?
Just about a year and a half.
How did Dallas take to a famous author arriving in their midst?
Oh, first of all, they're the most hospitable people I've ever met. So that it was a continuing 2 or 3 months of welcomes. And we live about a half block from Southern Methodist. And they have about 23 libraries, and it was just an embarrassment of riches for me. There's nothing under the sun that you can't research, and I've been working on a book about the time when there were 3 popes in the world, and it was bad for business. And the Bridwell Library there is a famous theological library, but the books that they did not have, they put on some kind of a telegraph wire, and these special books, one came in from Seattle the next day, and one came in from Florida. And they interchanged these books among college libraries throughout the United States.
I was going to ask you about researching, because all of your books, many of them have political themes, the course in Fritzi's Honor, the Mafia. In Ireland, did you find yourself cut off from research facilities?
No, I think it's like, for example, they have a tree every now and then that appears in Ireland and has little torn shreds of handkerchiefs tied to the branches. Now, any child of two would knows why it's there, and I puzzled about it, and I found out that it's a cure for toothaches if you tie a torn rag to this particular tree. Well, the same thing goes for research on, for example, the Mafia. I grew up in New York. I've been in the motion picture business in the theater for about 23 or 4 years. And I had written a book called Mile High in 67, which is about a man who invented prohibition. And by inventing prohibition, he established organized crime in the United States, and I had to do a lot of reading about that at the time. And from 67 until I began this book, Fritzi's Honor, I collected about 70 books on organized crime.
Mm. So you, I was going to ask you, because in Fritzi's Honor, the speech patterns of the people seem to be very authentic. There was one point, for example, I thought it was a typo, where one of the characters said, "And I want my $330.
Yeah.
And I said, that's got to be a typo.
Yeah.
And then it was repeated and repeated. And then I suddenly realized that the Mafia, in speaking of millions and thousands of dollars,
yeah,
would actually use the term $300.
Yeah. Well, yeah, $330 is $330,000. And in the book, I mentioned that I thought they began to talk like this just to confuse the tourists in Las Vegas.
You obviously must have a fondness for New York, because much of the action, not only of that book but other books, is
very much. So I'm the just deep dyed in the wool New Yorker. I grew up on Washington Heights in New York, and my father was a lawyer here, and I went to DeWitt Clinton High School, and I can do about 9 of the 14 New York dialects, and I'm kind of a student in New York.
It's a colorful city to put a story into, isn't it?
Nothing like it, because if anything that comes up in the dramatic construction of the novel that you need to reflect a particular mood or a circumstance, it is happening right now in New York.
You got off to a relatively late start as a novelist. How did that happen? I guess you were in your 40s.
I was 42 when I began to write.
See, there's still hope for me.
Oh, gosh, wow. I remember over the years at least two young fellows who had written hit novels when they were very young, and they faced this thing of writing another novel, and both of them ended in suicide because they had nothing to write about. And I think that the creative writing schools that teach young writers to write from their own experience, when storytelling is fantasy, and from my own point of view, I prefer to write about pure story. But the idea of starting at 42 was just a fortunate circumstance, because I had lived a long time, and I had been all over the world by that time. I went around the world on the old Dollar Line when I was 17 as a waiter, and I was in the hotel business, and then I was in the motion picture industry for about 22 years, and I was in the theater for about 2 or 3. So that all this stuff piles on, and it makes a veneer, and it's all the peripheral acquaintances and experiences that you have that comes down to a simple thing like the correct dialectical speech for Mafiosi in Brooklyn.
The Manchuria Candidate, of course, was a smash hit. Did this give you the impetus to go with this on a full-time basis?
Oh, no, that was my second book.
Mm-hmm.
My first book was called The Oldest Confession, and the publisher...
You had an art thief, as I recall.
Yes, and the publisher had a big hole in his schedule, so that instead of taking 11 months to produce the book, he actually produced it in 4 months. In the ensuing time, the paperback rights were sold and the film rights were sold, so I never had to look back. And then when I came to the second book, which is always called the crucial book in American writing, I was entirely financially prepared to be able to take the time to do the necessary amount of rewriting.
Did you ever miss the or worry about the fact that a regular weekly or biweekly paycheck wasn't coming in?
Only because that first book sold those rights so fast that I had a cushion of about two years to work, and it didn't take that long because of all the books I've ever written, a book called An Infinity of Mirrors took the longest, and it took too long, I think, for a professional writer. It took me 3 years, but The Manchurian Candidate took 5 months to write. And it's the only book that I ever wrote that I worked backward from the ending, the way you would plan a military campaign. And in any event, that 5 months again picked up the slack of the financial requirement. And I have been, though, from the very first day, a professional writer.
Is your goal to publish a book on a yearly basis?
Well, I've done that. I've had books. They come out on the average of every 14 months.
Mm-hmm.
That book, An Infinity of Mirrors, was a three-year hiatus, and that's the longest one.
You're a writer who... takes advantage of the latest electronic aids, such as word processing.
Oh, yeah.
What do you have exactly, and how do you make use of this modern technology?
Well, I have a advanced model of an Olivetti, and it actually saves slave labor. Now, when you... Well, let's say the average novel is 500 typewritten pages. Well, that means... because the real results are in the rewriting, that means five times retyping the same 500 pages, and that comes out to 2,500 pages of slavery. So with the processor, you correct electronically. The stuff comes up on the screen, and you make all the corrections, and you type all that out, and now you go through the hard copy with a pen and make all the corrections over again, and now feed all those changes into the machine. So that instead of writing 2,500 pages, you actually type maybe 600 out of the original 500, including the original 500.
Well, when you make these changes, when you make these revisions, does that destroy the previous version?
Oh, no. You make these right in one line. You know, you might like to insert a whole paragraph in the middle of a sentence, and you're able to do that. With this electronic process. And it does a lot of other things.
Do you get a printout that you can actually rip off?
Yeah, it prints out at the rate of 550 words a minute.
Does it separate itself into
yes.
writer-sized paper?
Oh, sure. It's not on a continuous roll. It has a feeder, and it feeds sheet after sheet, and it justifies the right-hand margin, and it also... there's a word, it's called pagination. It means that if you have if you insert a whole massive copy, say you insert two pages, a new copy, in the middle of the old copy, the machine repaginates that so that it all comes out into the standard, even pages.
Really, it saves a vast amount of time.
Oh, my word, I should say so. And of course, along the way, there are a lot of small conveniences that would only appeal to a typist.
I notice that food plays a major role in Pritzi's honor. Some of the dishes that you describe sound Delicious. You are, I assume, a gourmet.
Well, I wish I could say I was. I have a theory that no one who refuses to eat fish can call himself a gourmet. We write about three pieces a year for Gourmet magazine, and it's taken us all over the world. And I've been interested in food and the history of food for a long, long time, but I can't call myself a gourmet.
Do you cook as well?
No, I don't. No.
What are your favorite dishes?
I think almost anything that excludes fish on the entire Italian roster.
Italian?
Yeah, on the entire Swiss roster. It's kind of cryptosexual food, and it's absolutely delicious.
Did I get that right? Anything that excludes fish?
Yes.
You will not eat fish?
Yes. Well, that's why I can't say I'm a gourmet. Because I think if one were to say he is a gourmet, he must be brave enough to eat anything. And I think I don't eat fish because my father probably shouted while we ate it.
Well, New Yorkers are not known for their interest in fish anyway. Maybe because of the condition of our rivers and harbors. I don't know. What about going to Dallas? You're going to have to change your eating habits a little bit. The restaurants, you're going to have to focus on barbecue?
No, it's all... Or Tex-Mex. No, they now have about 7 first-class restaurants, and it's getting better all the time. It was probably like Australia before the Italians and the Greeks came into Australia and began... We were in Toronto a week ago, and they had abominable food until these ethnic restaurants began to cook. And in Dallas, that's exactly what's happening. We have Greeks and Italians and many French. And these investors are coming in from Europe and spending money, and the Texans spend a lot of money, so that French cuisine has a chance in Dallas.
You published a cookbook.
Yes, a Mexican cookbook. Yeah, called The Mexican Stove, with my daughter. And that was a labor of love.
Let me ask you a little bit about the financial. When you were in Ireland, were you able to take advantage of the very liberal tax laws that Ireland offers to writers?
No. The way that works is that British, French, and perhaps Spanish writers are forgiven all taxes when they leave their country. Americans, no matter where you live in the world, and we lived in 7 different countries, are required to pay taxes to Washington, in our case, Baltimore. But there's no forgiveness. There was a forgiveness from Irish taxation. However, no matter where you live in the world, the United States has made a tax treaty which permits you to deduct the local taxation from the American taxes anyway. So, in every way, there was no tax advantage for living in Ireland. It was just the last uncrowded country in the world.
Ireland, of course, has a great tradition of literature. I believe there's one American still living there and writing, Don Levy.
Oh, yes. I think he's become Irish.
He looks Irish.
Yes.
He was in town not too long ago. I saw pictures of him in the very
tweedy
jacket, knickers, and
things
like
that.
Did you join the writing community in Ireland when you were there?
No.
Associate socially with...
No, I never have anywhere that I've ever lived. And I don't know. I think it's the kind of a thing that one would do if one started young. But I started at 42, and I was set in my social habits anyway. And I've never sought out writers. I have some good friends who are writers.
I perceive you as a writer of action, rather than a writer of philosophy in the way that Robert Stone or Updike might write. Do you go along with that perception?
Oh yes, by all means. I'm a storyteller. Yeah, I'm a storyteller, and it seems to me, looking backward on my books, that they're mostly about the abuse of power. And I found a kind of self-fascinating vein in all aspects of the abuse of power.
Today it was announced that John Updike won the Pulitzer Prize for Literature for his book, Rabbit is Rich. Is there any nagging thought in the back of your mind that, gee, I'd like to win the Pulitzer someday?
No. This is the way it goes. When I got back from the first tour for United Artists in Europe, they had changed the system to what they called an executive committee system, whereby if a mistake is made, it's kicked around the table until it's lost. But if an individual makes a coup, it goes around the table as far as the boss, and he gets the credit. And that produced a conflict in me, and also two duodenal ulcers. So my wife said, you have to get into something else, and we began to think about what I might be able to do, and the only thing I could do was spell. So I started as a professional writer, and I will say as a professional entertainer, and I am in this business to make as comfortable a living as I can.
What kind of day is it for you as a writer as you get up in the morning in Dallas? How do you organize your day?
Well, for so many years, I've written 7 hours a day for 7 days a week. And then I have lunch at my desk, and I take a nap for 1 hour every day, which was something that started when we moved to Mexico, and we were about 7,400 feet, and there was 11% less oxygen in the air. So that it was necessary to take a nap, and that became a habit. So that what you might call discipline is with me a motor habit. The left side of my brain is accustomed to having the right side move, and the two hands are going at a typewriter. And the few times that I've ever taken a holiday, that is a non-working holiday, as I walk along, my hands are going in a typing motion because of this motor habit. Now you have to have. I think that almost anyone can develop the discipline to write if they write 1 hour a day at the same time, and then after 60 days they'll find they're a little bit nervous because they're not doing that. I don't think that's all you need. I think you have to have character, and I think you have to have talent. But the it's a big help to have this motor habit that keeps you going.
You believe in the discipline of a writer or a potential writer to at least sit down at his desk every day and make some effort.
Oh, absolutely must. I've known people who start to work and they have the feeling of what's going on in the pub, and they have to go down to find out what's happening. And once they leave their desk, it could be 3 days before they get back to working again, and the working period gets smaller and smaller. But it isn't only a working time. It's a matter of focusing, concentration, and all the secondary the things that produce the ideas that structure the drama of the story.
Well, one last question. I have to bring this up because some time ago I had an interview with William Styron, who was telling me that he is a great aficionado of alcoholic spirits. And that, if anything, having a number of drinks as he writes or before he writes enhanced his creative processes. What do you think about that?
Well, I would think that certainly would work, but it would only work with one man out of 1,200. I think an extraordinarily sensitive man who gets into a scene and actually can't continue to write it because it's sharpening all of his senses enormously, is comforted by the narcotic effect of alcohol, and it soothes him and brings him down. But I would say the other 1,200, 1,200 would just eventually fall off to sleep, or they just aren't as sensitive to start with to need that dulling.
I would think that it would only work in the initial periods where alcohol tends to, although it's a depressant, it actually, oddly enough, stimulates people initially before they fall off to sleep, And it would probably work at that point. But after a given amount, it would seem to me to just do the opposite.
Well, you know, every now and then you see on the flap of a jacket that the book took 12 years to write. And when I read that a book takes 12 years to write, I know the writer has martinis for breakfast. Because if you are, as we were speaking before, a professional writer, you are writing for a goal, just as a banker would be, or a fly casting fisherman, and that you have to have a continuity of product, and at least that's my own requirement. I think everybody should do it the way it works best for him.
Richard Condon, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Author Richard